来嘛，不要输了，等你的，不要输了，等你的，来嘛，来嘛，哎，来哎，来哎，来哎，不要输了，等你的，好下哎。
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies on iTunes and via the web. I'm your host, Nick Cheeseman, a fellow at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific. Today I'm talking with Mary Margaret Steedley, a professor of anthropology at Harvard University, on the sidelines of the Association for Asian Studies conference in Seattle about Rifle Reports, a story of Indonesian independence. Published in 2013 by the University of California Press. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. This is a real treat to get to talk about my book.
We're looking forward to it. Thank you. Rifle Reports, your book, tells a story about the struggle for Indonesian independence up to the late 1940s from the outskirts of the Indonesian nation, Karo Land in North Sumatra. Can you begin by explaining why you decided to write about those events from there?
Thanks, Nick. Well, first of all, this is my second book about Karo Land. It would be a long and circuitous route to tell you how I got there, but it was a somewhat accidental choice of a place to do dissertation research. And my dissertation was concerned with spirit mediums and how stories about spirit, how people told stories about spirits in their lives. It's just sort of the human spirit interface, I guess you could say, in a variety of contexts among the Karo, who were at that time about 50%, maybe a little bit less, Christian, maybe a quarter Muslim, and the remainder, in the Indonesian term, unconverted or without a religion, actually following a set of practices around ancestral veneration. So the first project, which brought me to Karo Land, was concerned with spirits and ghosts and things like that. And the Karo, who are actually pretty sophisticated about these things, were puzzled that an anthropologist would be interested in supernatural beliefs and things like that, instead of what is properly an anthropological topic, that is kinship. Because a Karo anthropologist some years before had written a book about the kinship system, which they're very proud of. At any rate, they did not understand, either the people who were spirit mediums themselves or people who were not or who were Christianized, they saw very little purpose in a study of ghosts and supernatural beliefs and things like that. So it was a little difficult to get them to talk about it. But what it seemed like nobody would ever stop talking about was what they did during the period of Indonesia's war for liberation. We'd be on bus rides and two strangers would meet and they'd start in on telling these stories, often rather formulaic, about where they'd been, what they'd done. Men told yarns about their experiences in coffee shops, and women told stories about this in the market. So it seemed to me, and I should add that this is, the Karo were deeply committed to the nationalist project, but there was virtually nothing that had been written in Indonesia or any kind of recognition that they'd received from the central government about their place in the struggle. So, you know, their feeling was, we've done all this. Why has nobody noticed? Why are we still on the outskirts of the nation? So I thought, well, this is a topic that's asking to be done. And also it's something that people actually think is worthwhile and would like to have done. So that was the inspiration in the first place. It became more complicated over time as I came to learn more about what went on, what kinds of experiences people had, and more about the period and some of its political complexities.
Can you say something more about this deep commitment? What was it that brought them into the struggle? And perhaps also, mm-hmm. so we're using that term, mm-hmm. you can signal the importance of that term work as against the alternatives available to
you. Yeah, it's really an important term. I'm glad we'll have a chance to talk about that. I suppose you could say that during the New Order period, up until 1998, the Suharto regime, a particular form of patriotic citizenship was, I don't want to say enforced, but definitely promoted by the government, in which direct participation in the struggle for independence was recognized as a part of being Indonesian. So ethnic groups like the Chinese in particular, who were seen as being less committed, this is part of the justification that was later given for their marginalization within the state. The parts of Indonesia where either there was opposition to the nationalist movement, as in parts of the Moluccas, or in places which were not actually a part of Indonesia at the time, as, for example, East Timor and Papua, were likewise not considered to be as integral a part of the nation as other places. Pushing it even further, the army, which was being presented as the only ones who actually did anything, were granted a kind of super citizenship, which gave them, to borrow from your panel tomorrow, a kind of impunity that continues to the present. It was something that was politically important to recognize the multiplicity of ways that different groups, whether we're talking about ethnic groups or class positions or gender or out islands versus central Java, what kinds of things have been going on and how you could think about this construction of a nation that wasn't simply a celebration of military triumphalism. So that's kind of a big piece of what seemed to be important to me about this. And particularly, I wanted to emphasize the things that women did and the kinds of stories that women told about their experience, because that was virtually unwritten for any part of Indonesia, other than the most kind of trivial sorts of writing. Women did things too, and that's it. And I wanted to say, let's look at how complicated it actually was. So that's kind of, I would say, a kind of background to, what makes this worth doing. The second question that you asked, which was about why I refer to this period of time as the independence struggle rather than the Indonesian Revolution, which is the common academic term. And there are several reasons for this. The first one, and the one that's most important to me, is that I'm following the terminology of my informants. They did not speak of it as the revolution. And in fact, when at the beginning I thought I could use that term, they didn't understand what I was talking about. And in fact, that's how I began to see that there was a very clear distinction that they were making between what they called revolusi and perjuangan, or struggle. The struggle was the complicated actions focused on the achievement of national sovereignty and the repelling of an outside force. So it was an outside enemy that they were facing. Revolution referred to revolution in reference to acts of internal violence within the community, reprisals against village chiefs who supported the Japanese, struggles between various militias, either over politics or spite or a whole variety of other things. So there are a whole range of forms of violence in which Indonesians were fighting with other Indonesians rather than in some kind of effort to produce a kind of unified national community. Now, the problem with that is that it's also the terminology that was supported by the Suharto regime, where the word revolution was pretty much banished from the vocabulary after Sukarno had made it into a kind of token of nationalism. The Suharto regime really rejected that as a concept and went to the more, I guess you could say, vacuous notion of struggle. But I thought that in addition to enabling me to make a distinction that my informants wanted to make between two forms of activity that went on during the period, it also, struggle was a more inclusive term. It included a lot more different kinds of activities, from propaganda rallies to rolling cigarettes for the soldiers to learning first aid or teaching classes. It was a whole wide range of activities that seemed to fit better under a rubric of struggle than of revolution. And then the final reason, this is the one that really tipped me over into the to that camp, is I think that there's something a little questionable about referring to this period as a revolution, not because it didn't affect a transformation of the political system. It did, quite clearly, I think. But rather because if you understand that the Dutch colonial rule in the Indies ended with the Japanese invasion in 1943, and the Dutch were expelled at that point, then the struggle had to do with keeping out an external enemy, the Dutch who wanted to come back, rather than of overturning a government that's already in place. So, you know, I don't have an exact, it's a very iffy kind of situation, but rather than following the kind of automatic referencing of this as a revolution, I thought better to stay with a term that's ambiguous and somewhat problematic.
Nevertheless, you suggest that you don't want to tell another story of resistance from below. We don't misunderstood struggle in that way either.
Right.
It's on the one hand, it's not a story of victimization. On the other, it's not a celebration of subaltern resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So then, if not, then why not?
Well, it's not subaltern resistance because these are people who are trying to get into the nation, not to resist it. They want to be recognized. They want to be part of it. So that's quite a different thing. They're not fighting against the... It might be that they should have been, but they were not. They were trying to be a part of it. They were trying to participate. And it was one of the things that's really striking is that unlike many other ethnic groups in Sumatra and presumably elsewhere as well, the level of support for nationalist activism throughout the period was extremely high. I'm not willing to say it was 100%. It obviously wasn't. There were some who opposed the opposition to the nationalist movement, but it was quite striking the extent to which the entire population was mobilized during this time. And I should add, it was mobilized enthusiastically, even though they had very little sense of what Indonesia as a kind of a unified region with some kind of claim to political sovereignty was. They wanted to get rid of the Dutch. They wanted to have autonomy. They thought about much of it in terms of material goods and benefits that were going to come. But on the whole, there's a striking sense of mass participation in this not fully understood movement. I think that might be a little more common in nationalist movements, and particularly anti-colonial nationalisms, than we sometimes give it credit for. A lot of the models of nationalism, Ben Anderson, for example, who looks at nationalism as emerging from a sense of shared identity emerging through reading or through the educational system and the educational hierarchy. But it presumes a starting place, which is a small group of, excuse me, educated elite men. And I wanted to kind of see, if you open that up, if you say, wait a minute, let's see what was going on the ground, how does it look?
And the extent of participation mm-hmm. really does become apparent in the later chapters of mm-hmm. the book, which we'll come to mm-hmm. shortly. But I'd like to cover a couple of other aspects of mm-hmm. the book and how you approach the research before we go mm-hmm. into the sure. chapters. One is your use of the expression when referring to the book that it is an ethnographic history. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by ethnographic history, and why does it matter for you to write history ethnographically?
Okay. That's it. You picked some good questions. That's a good one. There are some people who talk about historical ethnography, and I didn't want to exactly do that. Historical ethnography is a kind of taking of historical text and looking at them in a broader social context. It's basically social history with a little more of a kind of symbolic anthropological overlay, seems to me. When I talk about ethnographic history, what I mean is a history that is constantly toggling back and forth between moments, that has to be simultaneously aware of the time that's being described, the time of the interview, and all of the moments in between. So it's a very different kind of temporality that's always aware of that. If you're talking to people rather than texts, texts can be problematic too. But if you're talking to people in particular, you don't get to say, you know, this is a memory of this particular event in the past. It's the memory of this particular moment in the past as told to particular people in a particular present, but one that's been mediated by everything that's come in between. Not only that, but you then have to add in the other layer of the understanding of the writer in configuring it afterwards. Because much of, you know, what I have taken away from this really became clear for me afterwards. And in fact, in some cases, after the end of the New Order regime, then you could start seeing ways that particular moments were especially telling, let's say. So it's this, it's sort of starting from the assumption that ethnography is predicated on face-to-face encounters. And then you think about what are the implications when you try to tell a historical story while keeping that constantly in your eye, in the reader's eye as well.
What kind of challenges did you encounter using that approach? Mm-hmm. You mentioned, for instance, the risk, or perhaps it's not a mm-hmm. risk, of the ethnographer buying into the narrative mm-hmm. of the teller. Can you briefly say something about
how you manage to work? This is the ethnographic seduction. It's very hard to dislike people when you're in a conversation with them. There were a few that I had some serious trouble with, but mostly there's something about that one-on-one relationship that demands a certain amount of trust on both sides. That makes it hard sometimes to maintain a critical distance. At the same time, your informant has either because just wanting to be friendly or collegial or being impressed with having a foreigner come to talk to them or being annoyed that a foreigner is coming to talk to them or whatever feelings they happen to have, those are going to play into this as well. So there's always this kind of constant building of at least a temporary relationship that that's in one way, and particularly when you're talking about a person's life and they're trying to show you what they're thinking, you're trying to identify as much as you can with it to make sense out of, to see it from their point of view. And it's something you never quite do, of course, but that wish, that desire to understand and to appreciate another person's experience, I think, is really it's at the heart of the ethnographic endeavor, but it's also a bit of a danger because it's easy for people to lie to you. It's easy for you to be deluded about what you think they're saying, which is maybe not necessarily what they are. So there's lots of room for mistakes and for misreadings and misinterpretation, particularly when you're working in a cross-cultural setting. And if you're working in a language that's not your first language, you're going to miss a lot of things. There's a lot that's going to be missed.
Relatedly, mm-hmm. you also stressed that unlike the political scientist, you didn't write the book to try to solve puzzles about mm-hmm. how and why people acted the way they did, mm-hmm. so as to cast light on some general mm-hmm. phenomena, but rather that you wanted to retain a sense of puzzlement. So why does the mm-hmm. sense of puzzlement matter for doing...
Because it seems to me that there's always more to be learned. And the problem with solving puzzles is that once the puzzle is solved, it's done until somebody finds a new puzzle in the same set of issues. What I find appealing is just, and it's because I'm looking at stories. There's obviously there are going to be other times when you do want to get to the bottom of things. If you're doing human rights work, for example, this kind of, well, anything goes and let's retain our puzzlement about what really happened, that won't fly. It's just not appropriate. But in a case like this, where there is so much uncertainty and so much instability in what could have or did happen at a particular moment in time, I think it's really important to hold on to the sense that we don't understand everything. It also introduces a little bit of necessary modesty in how we approach other people's lives. And for me, that's really essential in anthropology, probably more than any other discipline, because so much of it is dealing directly with people.
Mary, if it's okay, mm-hmm. Let's move from the larger questions mm-hmm. and we'll return to them, but and go into Karo land.
Okay.
Can you briefly set the scene for us? Tell us a little bit more about the place, mm-hmm. the people, and the years leading up to the period on which the book is concentrated.
Okay. Yeah, don't let me go on too long about this, though, because I can. Yeah, give me that when it's enough. Karo are a peasant peasant-based ethnic society of the North Sumatran uplands. Karolan, they're one of the Batak, part of the Batak ethno-linguistic group that all have similar kinds of kinship systems. They're very strongly based in kinship. And I will spare you the details of that. They were incorporated by the Dutch into the province of East Sumatra, the residency of East Sumatra, in the late years of the 19th century. Actually the early 20th century, I think it was 1904 when the peace treaty was signed, largely because the Dutch wanted to pacify the entire region, and partly to block the incursions of Achenese. So they wanted to make the Bataks their friends by Christianizing them and so on, in order to form a blockade against against Islam and specifically against Aceh. So they pacified the region and then didn't really do very much. It's kind of interesting. You think about colonialism as being this massive exploitative system, which it was in the lowlands. This was a plantation area famous for Delhi tobacco, for palm oil plantations now, and rubber. It was an enormous economic zone for the Dutch colonial state. Enormous amounts of money were coming out of this area. But the Karo were not, there's no money up there. They just wanted to keep people quiet. So they were brought into the colonial state. A kind of indirect rule system was set up. And again, I'm going to spare you the details of this. But basically, the Karo were pretty much left alone. A road was built. They developed commercial agriculture and fruits and vegetables primarily. But there wasn't that much of a colonial impact. The missions didn't really have much effect either. And it wasn't until 1965 that you saw massive conversions to Christianity. So, but the Karo were kind of on the outskirts of colonialism as well. They were at the Karo land is about, I think, 50 kilometers or so from the city of Medan, which is, I think, Indonesia's fourth largest city now. But it was the main hub of the plantation zone. So they were close enough to have a lot of influence from the European establishment on the coast, but without much way to exploit it other than through marketing fresh produce. So they weren't horribly affected by Dutch colonial rule, but in a whole variety of ways, the establishment of a colonial administration created all sorts of political problems in the same way that colonial establishments do most everywhere, by formalizing certain relationships and delegitimizing other ones. They set in play a whole series of kind of problems that later come back. And that's pretty much what happened during the independence struggle. By the time of the Japanese invasion in 1943, 42, I believe it was, the Karo had begun to aggressively involve themselves in education in particular. They had started out way behind the other groups in the area and had pretty much caught up. So there was a lot of available schooling. There was a lot of interest in modern ways, let's say, but without, there was a kind of blockage of getting anything done. So that's kind of the situation at the time of the beginning of independence. And Tony Reed has really written a wonderful book, The Blood of the People, about the early part of the struggle, mainly from the perspective of Maidan and what was going on there. And but the problem is that because of blockades during the period of the struggle, not much information about what was going on in the uplands made it to the city. And so it winds up being a blank locally, even more so when you use sources from Java. Nobody has a clue what's going on. It's really, and it's not surprising because the various organizations change names all the time. People move from one group to the next. The affiliations are never clear. You can have a group in Sumatra with the same name as a group in Java, but they have no connection to each other. It's just, you know, it's very, very wild. And early on, the scene in Sumatra was perceived from Java as just being out of control, undisciplined. And to some extent, that wasn't not entirely wrong.
Well, we'll go into those events more momentarily.
Yeah.
Maybe we can work through chapter by chapter, referring to the titles of the chapters, because they're wonderfully evocative of their subject matter. The first chapter is the Golden Bridge. What was the Golden Bridge, and why start the beginning?
Okay. The Golden Bridge was a phrase that Sukarno used several times in speeches to refer to independence. It's the independence of the Golden Bridge to the future. And he rather carefully left unspecified what was going to be on the other side of that bridge. It was, you know, this moment we're going to all walk across this bridge together and we'll be in independence. And but the specifics of what that meant were left open. So it was this vision of moving into a glorious future, but without any particular certainty about what that actually meant. And I thought that that not only was that a kind of key phrase in Sukarno's rhetoric, but it also seemed to me to reflect the Caro attitude, that they completely bought into this idea that that getting rid of the Dutch and becoming a nation was going to lead them into a delicious future. And that was the term that was repeatedly used when they talked about it. But as they themselves told me over and over that, you know, they didn't know where they were going. They just wanted to get on this bridge. So that was the image that I was trying to start with, this notion of a trajectory, a pathway that was leading to something, and it was something glorious. But, you know, you had to get there first before you knew what it was.
I was struck by this term, the delicious future, that independence would be delicious. Mm-hmm. It does come up again and again in the narratives. Can you say something more about it? Because it seems to be a term on which a lot of things are hinge or turn.
Yeah, it did. I mean, this is one of those places where, you know, you follow your informants, and when a word starts appearing repeatedly in stories, then you start to take it seriously. And they use the term, the Indonesian term sometimes, enak, and they also used the Kara term, Ntaba. So both terms were used. And I assume that it must have been a term that was used in speeches. But it also, you know, it's very evocative. It's a very, it's not just delicious in the sense of food, but it's also nice. And pleasing, and usually pleasing in a sensuous way. Not erotic, but more, you know, physically enjoyable. So you can have a pleasant nap, for example, and that can be enak, or a pleasant bath, or, you know, a pleasant meal. It kind of goes on, but it has a sense of a kind of embodied enjoyment. And I think that's kind of where they were going with this. That this idea that independence was something delicious, it was something tasty, it was something well, pleasant doesn't quite capture it, but it's this sense of yummy.
Well, let's see if we can draw it out through some of the discussion of narratives. And and as we're going into the narratives, could you say something more about why so much of the book does turn on narratives, what they mean for you, and in particular the narratives of women and their wartime experiences?
Well, I started out, before I was an anthropologist, I started out as a folklorist. And I did a master's degree in folklore before deciding there was no real academic future in that field. And I somehow thought that anthropology would be more lucrative, which it was, but not much. At any rate, that background, I think, made me much more attentive to language, to the way that stories are produced. And the formal elements of spoken narrative of stories. So that made me very attentive to what stories were about. And that's kind of where I began. And then the second piece of that is, if you're trying to approach events in the past from a different perspective than what is available archivally, then you basically have to talk to people if they're still alive. But then the questions become, how do you understand those conversations? How do you make sense of the way people talk about things? How much of it is a tale type? How much of it is something that's has borrowed elements or aspects that are somehow or another formulaic, taken from folk tales, for example. There's stylistic elements that pick up folktale formats as well. So those are the things that I was really kind of very attentive to methodologically. That's what I wanted to see, is how do you think about the stories that people tell in a kind of archival spirit, but with an awareness that this is an archive that is constantly morphing and changing position. Then the other thing is, I just like stories. They were exciting. They were fun. And the stories that men and women both told about independence, it was like, this was the best time of their life. You talk to old ladies on a bus and they would get really excited telling you the list of places that they went. Or you talk to a man and he would, you know, just go on and tell you story after story of the crazy things that happened. You know, I repeated some of them in here. The guy who shot up in the air and shot himself. He accidentally set off his gun and then the bullet went straight up and came back down and hit him. Or things like that. And they told all these stories about themselves. They kind of presented themselves as fools a little bit, rather than as being dangerous. But they really kind of enjoyed talking about their own foolishness. But it was particularly, I think it was especially interesting hearing the stories that women told, because these were so different from their ordinary conversations. Storytelling in Karoland is, for the most part, I would say, a kind of male prerogative, right? Certainly used to be, probably not so much anymore, for two reasons. One is that women did most of the farm work, which kept them busy, and men sat around in coffee shops and gambled and told stories. So that they were, not only did they have more time to tell stories, but they also had more practice in presenting stories to an audience that might not be familiar So they could produce stories that were nice and neatly enclosed, and perfect for, you know, the traveling anthropologist that puts down the microphone and says, now tell me a story. They would tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end. That's not the kind of storytelling that women generally did, village women in particular. Now, I have to say, I think that the involvement in the Christian church has changed that in a lot of ways. The church has provided a specific venue that women now talk in a lot. But for older village women, their conversations were primarily limited to their neighbors, and they were told in the midst of work. So you might tell a piece of a story today and another piece of it tomorrow, or refer in passing to a story. It's like the who was the comedian that talked about telling jokes by number? And you just say number 13 and everybody would fall over laughing because they knew which joke that was. It's the same kind of thing. If you're talking to an audience of people who've already heard all those stories, you're going to tell different kinds of stories. And those are unfortunately not the kinds of stories that the traveling anthropologist is that well equipped to understand as stories. I mean, it's certainly fine for information gathering, but they just don't work very well. Those were the things I was interested in. Now, for the women that I particularly talked to, their experiences during the independence struggle was a little bit different. For one thing, because they had something to tell about that made an exciting story. It wasn't like daily life, going to the fields or having a fight with your neighbor or whatever happens in everyday life. This was a period that was special. And it was special in ways that were gendered differently. In other words, young women who would normally be kept at home to take care of their younger siblings or to work in the fields or to cook the rice or all those things, did things that were different. They went out on their own. They learned things. During the evacuation of the Highlands, they traveled long distances, and they were particularly fascinated with the stories of their travels, even if it was something as seemingly routine as a list of the places where they stopped, and they would share these stories with one another. And we went to this village and this village and this village, and somebody would say, well, did you go to this one? We went there, and what happened there? And so there was really an interesting way that new kinds of narrative techniques were being developed around this particular set of experiences. And both because the kinds of stories that people told and the kinds of experiences that they had were so different than what was conventional and what had been recognized, I thought they were especially important to acknowledge. And early on, when I had, this is something I mentioned in the book, one of the early interview sessions I did, the village, as usual, went to see the village headman and sort of get permission to talk to people in the village. And I said what I was doing. He laughed at me. He just thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. When I talked to women about what they did in the struggle, that they didn't do anything. They just cooked rice. Before the struggle, they were cooking rice then. They cooked rice during the struggle. They cooked rice. Today, they're still cooking rice. What kind of struggle is that? But that wasn't how they saw it. They saw it as doing something important. And out of the ordinary, the sense of living in an extraordinary time and finding a way to tell about it was what I was really trying to capture in the stories. And I wanted to stay as close as I could to what they said while making sense of it for an audience of outsiders.
Well, let's take an example mm-hmm. of just one of the narratives, mm-hmm. and there are so many yeah. in the book that to urge listeners to take a look and read them themselves. But the story of the buried guns, mm-hmm. which is at the heart of the second chapter,
yeah.
can you give a synopsis of that story again? And what are the characteristics of that story that you would like to identify for listeners that you think go to the larger points that you're making about the research that you've done?
That was one of the one of the most interesting, and that building a whole chapter around, in this case, two individuals really, was because I had such a rich set of material for them. And the two characters were Slamet Ginting, who was the head of the largest of the militias, not the army, but the kind of volunteer freedom fighters in the Karo area. And so he was a major figure during this period. And so I met him. Well, he was one of the first people that I met, actually, when I started doing this project, he and his wife. So I went to visit them in their house. This is kind of a long way to get to the story. Sorry. But I went to their house and I said, here, I'm going to do this study of women in the revolution. And he says, I can tell you all about women in the revolution. I know everything there is to know, he said. His wife didn't say anything. She stayed in the corner. Anyway, he said he wasn't feeling too well and that I should come back later and we'd stay up all night and swap stories. And he'd tell me everything I needed and then I could go home and write my book right away. 2 months later, he died before I ever saw him again. And following up on that, I... met several times with his wife, who passed away just actually not very long ago at all, a couple of months ago. But I met with her and I said, you know, since your husband can't tell me his story anymore, maybe you can tell it to me. And so through that means of her speaking for him, I got her to tell this kind of story of her life and how she wound up being married off at 13 to this cousin that she didn't know for kind of political reasons and how what a kind of difficult situation she found herself in. And it went on. It was really funny and poignant and touching in many ways. But the core of it was the story of this of these guns that that her husband had acquired somehow. And there are various stories about how he got them. But he got them from the Japanese right after the surrender, either by hijacking a truck of guns or because a Japanese officer negotiated a deal and passed them on. At any rate, he got these guns. And at this point, his wife was staying in his home village up in the highlands. And he wasn't there that much because he was traveling around trying to recruit people and building up membership in the militia. And so he came and his friend showed up there one night with these guns and he said, ah, hey, we've got to do something with these guns. You've got to hide them. And she says, okay, I have an idea. Okay. She was part of village work group, an Aron, which is a collective shared work group. And she says, okay, what we'll do is I'll get the Aron to go up to the field. I have a rice field and we'll bury him in the rice field. And so she did. I'll cut this short because you can go on quite a long bit about the details of this. At any rate, the part of it that was funny is that so she was telling him how to do it. And she said, well, then I had to do it myself because he'd never even held a hoe. So she did the work, buried the guns. And then, you know, her husband went off. She went off and to visit her family elsewhere and then came back. And somehow the guns had been dug up. And those were the first guns of the independence struggle in East Sumatra. It was actually those guns that were dug up that became the first weapons of the militias that forced the announcement of independence to be made in Medan. It's kind of long and complicated. So for her, it was this extraordinary moment of what she did. You know, it was not, this is what my husband did. This is not about the struggle. This is not about the organizations. This is about how you dig a hole in the field, how you bury things properly, how you perform a task. And all of her stories were very much about how you successfully perform tasks that are given to you.
And the next couple of chapters develop the story out of the digging up of, of those guns. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, we don't have time to go into all of them. But I'd really like to jump ahead and ask you to say something briefly about the last chapters in the book, because 5, 6, and 7 all approach events in 1947 in different ways. Chapter 5, The Sea of Fire. What was the Sea of Fire? And why does it matter for this story of what happened in
Canada? Okay, great. The term Sea of Fire is normally applied to the burning of the city of Bandung in 1946, I think, 45, early in the independence period. And Lautan Api, it's a classic term that's used for this spontaneous, what was it? It was the nationalist militias, when they were ordered out of Bandung, retreated out of the city, but as they went, they burned large parts of the city as a statement of, you know, that they're not acquiescing to enemy commands. And that's become a kind of iconic moment in Indonesian nationalist history, the efforts of the youth of Bandung. In Karoland, the Sea of Fire refers to, it's a term that they've used there also, to refer to the burning of many villages and towns across the highlands at the time of the Dutch invasion in 1947. And likewise, as in Bandung, as the Dutch forces moved into the highlands, the nationalist propagandists had urged the people to move out as a demonstration of unwillingness to return to Dutch rule. And as people moved out, they were told to burn the villages as a kind of, as they put it, one guy put it to me, is that we had read in the newspapers about the way that the Russians stopped the Blitzkrieg by burning everything, so there wouldn't be it, so the German army couldn't have any resources there. So, but we forgot that we're in the tropics, so we didn't have a winter on our side. But anyway, what they did was they encouraged people to burn their houses, burn the villages, so that the Dutch would have no place to stay. Well, they didn't burn all the villages, but they did burn a lot of them. It wasn't so much the villagers themselves in most cases. It was the militias that did the burning after people moved out. But it was put to me by the wife of an important militia officer that everybody knows the Bandung Sea of Fire, but nobody knows the Karo Sea of Fire. And we burned the whole district. We didn't just mess around with a town, burned the whole thing. And that shows you how patriotic we were. So it's like 2 points. One is that I wanted to use that to describe the evacuation in which virtually the entire population of the Karo Highlands, which is some, I don't know, several hundred thousand people moved out and stayed in the woods, in shelters, in camps, in huts, much of them up in the area, in the border area of southern Aceh and northern Tapanuli. And so they moved out and they stayed out for about 6 months. So it was a period that really for Karo marked a very dramatic transition a time that really defined a break for them between a kind of colonial status quo, and they thought of it as a kind of move into modernity. They didn't quite put it in those terms, but it set things in motion in a kind of dramatic way.
And in chapter 7, you explore that point mm-hmm. through a song.
Mm-hmm.
Can you briefly explain why you use that song and mm-hmm. perhaps relate it back to the more general points that we've been discussing around memory practice and
mm-hmm.
why it matters for your work?
Yeah, okay.
Before we conclude.
The particular song was a long autobiographical improvisational work by a woman by the name of Sinek Brucato, who was a well-known performer during the period following the struggle. It was performed in a traditional genre of what they call katone, which is a kind of blessing song that's produced for ceremonies, and it's usually directed in praise of the sponsoring clan or subclan or lineage and their various kin groups, and it's heavily formulaic. But during the period immediately following the independence struggle, a number of people, most notably Sinek, produced katone katone texts that were based in personal experience and were accounts of this period of the evacuation and the travels. So these, actually, the songs which I started collecting during my first research time in Karelia before I started this project, were recorded, they were performed later on up and through the early 60s, relatively commonly, I think. And to some extent, still in the mid-90s, you hear one every now and then. This one struck me as being particularly effective, in part because it didn't follow the conventional pattern, so that when Caro heard it, they would say, well, this isn't as good as the one that's performed by somebody else. They didn't think it was as good. And the reason was that it was not completely loaded with the formulaic praise phrases and things like that. So it, you know, didn't have that kind of elegance. It was very simple language. That meant I liked it because I could follow it. I could understand it. And I could follow the storyline. It was very dramatic. So to me, it had a more compelling narrative structure and one that I could work with without having to stop every three words and footnote and explanation of some kind of traditional metaphor or kin term or something like that. But it was just this beautiful work that encapsulated, to me, this idea of that, in a way, I was trying to capture with the whole book, of people moving into an unknown future and pivoting it on what was lost as well as what was gained, and a sense of this incredible uncertainty about where they were going and the kinds of hardships that they went through. And then at the end, and one of the most intriguing twists in the whole narrative, Sinek tells in the song of meeting during their exile in Aceh, meeting with another older woman. And Sinek was sort of complaining about her hard lot and how they couldn't go home because they didn't have any clothes and didn't have any money. And the older woman says to her, and this is the song. The older woman says, "Yeah, you really had a hard time, but let me tell you what happened to me." And she tells of her losing her children to malaria during the period when they were in Aceh, and you know that now she can't go home. There's no home to go to because the children are gone. And at that point, Sini comes up with a conclusion that is extraordinary in the context of the kind of formulaic genre that she's working in, which is to recognize not that everybody had the same experience, but everybody had different experiences, that they suffered and struggled in different ways, and that they should talk about what happened with one another and acknowledge that, but without unifying it into there's only one way that we can struggle, there's only one way to suffer. I thought that was a really powerful and poignant kind of way to conclude the story.
One of the aspects of the mm-hmm. song that you point to, and I really mm-hmm. do want to ask about this, mm-hmm. is that the absence from the song of agents of terror and violence. Mm-hmm. Why is that? And what is it?
I don't know. I thought it was very strange. I just struck me as being odd that the song, what the song describes is travel through empty forests and up uninhabited mountainsides and with the fear of the Dutch, but no sign of them, with the fear of planes overhead. So that once you get into Sinek's personal experience, you're in this world where anything can happen, but it's for whatever reason, that's not pictured. The actual agents of violence, they don't encounter Dutch soldiers. They aren't bombed. And people were. They also don't encounter rebel militias or bandits, which is a more likely outcome when small groups are in the forest. And it turned out, I finally discovered on a follow-up interview with Sinek, is the reason that they didn't have trouble with bandits is that they were not, although the song depicts them as if it were a family traveling alone through the forest, in fact, that was not the case, that she and her family were traveling with an escort of soldiers, Indonesian soldiers, who were taking a group of political prisoners to a camp in Aceh. So they were guarded and protected. That doesn't come up in the song. What happens in the song is something that allows her to create a kind of common moment with other individuals. But it doesn't raise the possibility of revolution, of revolution, of us against us. There's no sign of that anywhere.
But it is part of struggle to get back to that.
It is.
For the reasons that you indicated.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mary, we could speak for another hour and still have so much more to talk about mm-hmm. after that. You've been very generous with your time. Before we close, I'm sure listeners would love to know what you've been working on since the book was published and what we can look forward to.
Well, as you may know, academic books these days, publishers encourage shortness. They encourage brevity. In order to get this book published, I had to cut a large chunk of the beginning, which dealt with the Japanese occupation. But more importantly, I had to end the story kind of in medias res at the beginning of the second military campaign. There is a whole other story that comes after this. And it's the story of how the army wins and how the state forms itself. And I decided when they said this has to be, you know, many pages shorter than it is, I decided that I would leave that part of my account out because it really is a different story. This is a story of what Caro thought they were doing. It's a story about the Golden Bridge. It's about this idea of independence that's at the end of that bridge. And I wanted to leave that kind of spirit in place. But the other piece of that is how a state latches onto this sense of aspiration and establishes itself and legitimizes itself. That's a piece that's still in need of some work, but I'm hoping to get that put together fairly soon. I've also been working on a project in the U.S. that's completely unrelated to this. It's on U.S. military culture, which is a strange topic to jump to from Indonesia. But if I were to get back to Caro Land, which I hope to do very soon, the issue that seems to me to really need attention now is the impact of the volcanic eruption in North Sumatra of Mount Sinabung, which is in the center of the Caro Highlands, which has been erupting for the last couple of years and has required another relatively massive evacuation of about an 11-kilometer circuit around the mountain. People have been moved into relocation camps. The terrain has been inundated with ash. I don't know exactly what the health impacts are, but they certainly can't be good. It's really a difficult situation and one that I'm really interested in seeing firsthand. As it is, I'm kind of keeping up with it through various media forms. Caro have gotten very good about using Facebook, among other things, to organize activities around this. But the environmental issues right now, I think, are the key thing that I would really like to think more about and to talk to people about and see, you know, what kind of impact that's having.
Well, I'm sure that just on the basis of your short remarks on the conditions there alone, we'll have listeners who will look into those events, as indeed I will. In any case, Mary Steedley, I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with me today about Rifle Reports, a story of Indonesian independence, and congratulate you on the book.
Thank you so much. This is quite a pleasure.
And thank you to everyone for listening. I look forward to having you join me again for another meeting with an author on new books in Southeast Asian Studies. And if you have the time, please do check out the New Books Network for a lot of other great channels. Hey, thank God,